Hello, and welcome to yet another episode of the Agnostic Salvation Hour. This is your host, Marshall Bass, along with
Cole Morgan
and Jennifer
and Howard. And we have along with us today a very special guest. I suspect that most of you are familiar with Robert M. Price. Currently, a professor of theology and scriptural study at Johnny Coleman Theological Seminary, which I believe is somewhere in Florida. A self-professed Christian atheist, and I might ask him what exactly that means, and author of a wide array of books, approximately 30 different books dealing with scriptural scholarship and the Cult of Cthulhu, or the fictional Cult of Cthulhu.
Bob, if one day you could write a book that's from Christ to Cthulhu, I would love that.
I sort of did an editorial in Crypt of Cthulhu about that, that my brother in Indiana still twits a Methodist minister friend of his with. I don't know if I could do a whole book, but it might be worth it.
Well, Bob, while we have you on the show, I wanted to take the time to mention the fact that you have another book coming out this March.
Would it be, there's a couple of things in the works. The one that should be out by then would be The Case Against the Case for Christ, in which I do like a chapter by chapter rebuttal to Lee Strobel's The Case for Christ. And that's at the printer right now, I'm told, and should be out very quickly.
Oh, interesting. And how can we get that book when it comes out?
It's from American Atheist Press, and it should be available on Amazon, but I'll be doing a kind of self-serving scam where I sell them autographed myself, and they can be ordered at, just from me directly at my email address, critic with a U.S. on the end, criticus@AOL.com. I don't know how much the price is yet. They haven't told me, nor the pages. That determines the price, and they didn't tell me yet.
Well, I'll be fascinated to read that book because I've listened to a number of debates involving William Craig. One involving, with you, and that was a fascinating debate. But one tactic I noticed that Craig uses when he debates individuals about the resurrection is that he just throws so much information out there that there's just no way you can critique it all.
Mm.
Your particular effort, I thought, was actually excellent. But another book that I was referring to is The Amazing Colossal Apostle that I believe you have coming out here shortly.
That's in another year, unfortunately.
Oh, yeah.
That's too bad.
That one's coming out from Signature Books in Utah. They published my pre-Nicene New Testament. This one is just entering the editing stages, not that I think it needs any, that's due in now April of 2011. It's the whole thing is The Amazing Colossal Apostle, The Search for the Historical Paul. And I can't wait to get that one out there, because the premise of it is that really we're no better off understanding the historical Paul than we are with the historical Jesus. And that isn't so widely known, because even liberal Protestant scholars tend to make Paul the center of the canon. So they can't really afford they would really be out to sea without Paul there. But unfortunately, they don't have any simple access to him either.
That's something that's always fundamentally bothered me with modern Christianity, is that it's so built upon the teachings of Paul, where it almost seems to ignore mm-hmm. large other parts of the Bible.
Yeah, Luther didn't seem to care about anything other than Paul.
Right. He was willing to put books like James, Jude, Hebrews, and Revelation into an appendix in his version of the New Testament, because he said they don't really preach the gospel. And one of my favorite statements of Luther, he said, if it's by Paul, John, or James, but it doesn't preach the gospel, it's not canonical. If it's by Herod, Pilate, or Judas, and it does preach the gospel, it's canonical.
Oh, man.
Well, let me ask you, do you think that there's any chance that Paul is just an amalgamation of different personalities and concepts, similar to what you believe about the historical Jesus?
Yeah, I never thought I'd come to this, but I've put together theories from Ferdinand Christian Bauer, plus a couple of contemporary scholars, Hermann Dettering and Robert Eisenman. And I just say that so I don't seem to take credit for other people's insights, but I've put them together in ways they might not approve. I don't want to blame them for my crazy views, but I think you can discern evidence in the Dead Sea Scrolls, in the pseudo-Clementine homilies and recognitions, which are two early Christian novels based on earlier material, some stuff that Josephus says and elsewhere, and come up with the idea that Paul, as we know him, is the same as the historical figure Simon Magus, or Simon the Magician, mm-hmm. and who is mentioned in both the Book of Acts and Josephus, and that he appears to have been a kind of a part of the entourage of these Herodians, like the ones that Paul meets in Acts. In fact, Drusilla and Herod Agrippa II and Bernice and Felix and so forth. And that he would be the same person also as Elymas the magician in the Book of Acts, who seems to be a doublet of Simon. Mm-hmm. And again, of an unnamed Jewish missionary to the court of Adiabene in Edessa, one of the ancient Antiochs. Several cities had that name. And Josephus tells us about Jewish missionaries that got the royal house converted to a sort of sectarian baptizing Judaism. And one of the missionaries told them, you don't really need to get circumcised and keep the whole nine yards, because your subjects will turn against you. Then it'll seem too alien to them. Whereas then other Jewish missionaries said, well, look, that's immaterial. You've got to do what Abraham said to do and accept circumcision. And they did. And Eisenman says, this looks an awful lot like the circumcision debate in the Book of Galatians and so on. And he pointed out that the tensions between Paul and the pillar apostles sound an awful lot like the scenario in the Dead Sea Scrolls, whereby some villain they call the mocker or the spouter of lies commits apostasy against the covenant in the midst of the brethren and creates his own sect, the Simple of Ephraim, who are Gentile converts. And I think Eisenman is right. This has got to be Paul. And so that we're reading about Paul when it refracted by different agendas, when we read about the spouter of lies, Simon Magus, or this unnamed non-circumcision missionary of Judaism. And this suddenly makes a lot of interesting sense of a whole lot of things in the Book of Acts. So I kind of think, there was an Apostle Paul, but he was Simon Magus, originally part of the Dead Sea Scrolls community.
Interesting.
Yeah, that is fascinating. but what do you think about, how do you explain then the dismissal of Simon Magus earlier in the Acts of the Apostles?
Well, because Acts is representative of a second century tendency to close ranks between different groups of Christians, depending on how you read it. As F.C. Bauer thought, it might be Torah obeying Christians and law-free Pauline Christians. Depending on another possible reading, it may be the early Catholic Church versus the Marcionites, who were Paulinist mm-hmm. Christians that rejected the law. But at any rate, Acts is trying to paper over the divisions in the early church, and it rehabilitates Paul in the eye. It seeks to rehabilitate Paul in the eyes of Christians that believe you should keep the law. And for them, he appears as a law-abiding Paul, subordinate to the 12 in Acts. But as for all of the stuff that they had rejected about Paul, they just split the character and make him into Simon Magus, which means a kind of anti-Peter, a false Simon. And they make him the father of heresy, who sought to buy apostleship. So this is typical in myths and legends, to split a character who was a villain into a hero and a villain. And it seems to me that's what's happened there.
Wow.
I think it's interesting that I hear this constant strain in modern Christianity that early Christianity was much more unified in its beliefs than what I've read in, you know, by actual people who study history, like yourself and other scholars that I've read. I didn't know if you had any comments about that. It seems to be a common thread that I've heard, you know, more and more about that early Christians were somehow unified in their beliefs as...
Oh, yeah, I don't know how anyone can read the New Testament and think that because it's filled with polemical denunciations cover to cover. In the Sermon on the Mount, it says that those who teach that Jesus came to abolish the law and the prophets will be least in the kingdom of heaven. Whereas over in Galatians, it says that any Christian that teaches you must be circumcised and keep the Torah is teaching a false gospel. And there are all manner of other similar vilifications all through the New Testament. The prophet is so-called Jezebel, whom John is attacking in the book of Revelation. That's apparently a Nicolaitan Gnostic prophetess, but she would no doubt have considered John to be Balaam and condemned him. And there are just all sorts of clashes within the New Testament. And sometimes they're aiming at villains whom we don't even know but must have existed at the time, and they all considered themselves Christians. So as far back as we can trace, there was division. It appears that the gloriously harmonious early church, a kind of a Barney the Dinosaur group, you love me, this seems to be a kind of fiction on behalf of the second century church. Once they eliminated the groups they didn't like, they said, well, of course, Jesus just started our church and we're the real thing. So that's really just propaganda.
And when you look at the volumes of letters written by the early church fathers, Irenaeus and Justin Martyr and Origen, I mean, it's pretty clear that there was a great amount of disagreement as to what exactly the message of Jesus was.
So you think that the faithful giving the impression that they had a unified faith going back to Christ was something that happened in the second century and has kind of been maintained as much as certain denominations can?
Oh, yeah, that's clearly the impression the book of Acts wants to give, and yet the author of it, who I imagine was Polycarp of Smyrna, he didn't do a great job of tying up all the loose ends, and it becomes very clear, as in chapter 6, for instance, with the Hellenists versus the Hebrews, that it was not a unified group. And there are plenty of clues there that are made more explicit when you look at so-called heretical literature from not much later. One book that should have really put an end to that was a book written in the 30s by Walter Bauer called Orthodoxy and Heresy in Earliest Christianity, where he showed that in various parts of the Roman Empire, the first movement to be known as Christian, actually in our terms, would be Marcionite or Gnostic or whatever, and that as far back as you can trace it, there were all these Christianities side by side, not just one original that was somehow distorted by these crazy heretics.
Now, I'm kind of curious about something you just said about Polycarp authoring the Book of Acts. What brought you to that conclusion? Because historically, I mean, yeah, we're all brought up believing that Luke was the author of Acts.
And how many carps was he exactly?
He was many fruit.
It means many fruits, yeah. Or much fruit. There's a lot of interesting evidence for this, but the case is best made in a book and an article shortly following it by David Trobisch. He did a book called The First New Testament, where he shows through many avenues of evidence. And this guy started out pretty conservative, actually. He's the son of Walter Trobisch, who has a bunch of InterVarsity books out. Well, David went in a different direction. He shows that it appears that the 27-book New Testament was an edition put together by a particular scholar, and that it was one of rival New Testaments for a while. He based his on expanding Marcion's Pauline scripture, the so-called Apostolicon, or Book of the Apostle. Polycarp added books onto that, apparently somebody did, he says. And there are all sorts of interesting lines of evidence. And he says this existed in the Christian marketplace for a couple of hundred years before Bishop Athanasius in 367 sent out an encyclical telling everybody, yeah, this is the New Testament we're using from now on. Don't keep copying and reading those other books. But it took that long. And even after that, it was a couple of centuries before you find manuscripts that have only our 27. Well, he says it looks as if we have an idiosyncratic edition, kind of like when I put out my pre-Nicene New Testament. I decided what books I thought ought to go in it. I translated it, etc. Well, somebody did this, and he then goes into different possibilities. It would have to be somebody we would probably have heard of, because it must have been a major voice in the New Testament. And he winds up showing, and he's not the first one, by the way. About 100 years ago, I think it was Alvin Boyd, Kuhn had suggested also that it must have been Polycarp, and that therefore the Theophilus to whom Luke and Acts are dedicated is the Bishop Theophilus of Antioch in the mid-second century. And there are all kinds of hints in the pastoral epistles. I think it's in 2 Timothy. There's this otherwise irrelevant little statement where Paul supposedly, others had suggested Polycarp wrote the pastoral epistles too. That wasn't Trobisch's idea. But he says, when you come, bring the scrolls I left with Carpus, which is another version of Polycarp. Why does he even bother saying that unless that's a kind of a clever reference to the edition you're reading? And the name Polycarp is smuggled into it. Or Bultmann showed how there are big passages that somebody, he called the ecclesiastical redactor, like the church editor, had added to John to make it more orthodox and to add material about the Lord's Supper and so on. Well, in one of the passages that seems to have to do with the Lord's Supper, Jesus says, whoever abides in me bears much fruit, Polycarp. So that wouldn't mean much if it didn't have to be somebody like him, of his stature in the second century church. But with these clues, it kind of sews the case up. And so Trobisch argues this in the first New Testament, and then in an article in Free Inquiry from about 3 years ago called Who Published the New Testament? But again, he's not the only one that has said it. He's just made the case for it. So it appears Luke is a reworked, padded out version of the Marcionite gospel, and that whoever did the padding out also wrote Acts to counteract Marcion's stance against the 12 apostles. And it was the same one, probably, who padded out John, as Bultmann said, and then. Added the thing in Revelation. Whoever adds to the words of this book will be in big trouble. So he wants his edition to be, you know, just as he right. left it. And so I think it's a brilliant hypothesis.
Bob, I've had a burning question. I've heard a recent apologetic argument for the authenticity of biblical scripture that I find hilarious in almost every way. And I wanted to see what you thought. Basically, the reason why the New Testament has to be true verbatim, if you will, is because we just have so many copies of it.
Yeah, early manuscripts.
Wow. Early manuscripts of it.
Yeah, I suggest whoever said that really didn't understand what other apologists say. They always do get to that, but usually they're making a more restricted claim, and they're trying to say that there's no real doubt as to what the New Testament texts originally said, that there's so many manuscripts and one can weed out a lot of the copying errors by comparing them, that we can arrive at virtually the original text that was written in the first century. I don't think that's quite valid, because we don't have any textual evidence before about 300 AD, and there's reason to believe that all of our manuscripts stem from an authorized edition, so that we wouldn't know what tampering has been made except by just a critical close reading. And there seem to be plenty of things that have been added and changed. But they're sort of right. There was not wholesale distortion, as people say ignorantly. I'm sure you've heard people say, well, the Bible's been translated so many times. Well, that doesn't really have that much to do with it. The fundamentalist is right when he says it has to do with the manuscript tradition, but they're wrong by thinking that the bottom line you get to there must span the couple of centuries between the writing of the original and the earliest copies we have. But if somebody actually says, you know, it's like a voting, you know, we got so many copies, it must be true. That's nonsense. But like William Lane Craig and all these guys would scoff at that. They'd never make an argument like that. So that's just like popular, ignorant fundamentalism there.
Have you heard of something called the Alpha Course? Are you familiar with that?
The Alpha Course?
Yeah.
No, I've never heard of that.
It's kind of like an apologetic kind of like seminar, if you will, for people that are on their way out, lapsing whatevers, if you get my meaning. And they make that argument within it. I thought it was quite funny.
Oh,
among a variety of other ridiculous arguments.
No, terrible.
They read the passage from Josephus mentioning Christ as if it's truth.
That's an awful mistake.
Yeah, that's what I thought as well.
Yes, yeah. I absolutely.
There's
agree
just
with
so
that.
Many arguments against that. That is so sad. There, you can really tell they're preaching to the choir.
Yeah,
they're just giving false assurance to the would be faithful rather than convincing anybody.
Well, I think more accurately, they're preaching to a group of people who wouldn't know better.
Yeah. Yeah. Otherwise, you'd never be taken in by that. Yeah. That's disgraceful.
Well, I want to go back to a question I had about Paul. Mm. Are you familiar with some of the theories that he may also be the same person as Apollonius? I believe that's how you pronounce it.
Yeah, I forget the author's name, but somebody long ago wrote a little booklet, Apollonius, the Mystery Man of the New Testament. Acharya S, or Acharya Sanning, I believe her old name is a pal of mine. She told me about this, or I read about it in one of her books, and I read it, and it's really fascinating. It's someone could have used Paul as a nickname for Apollonius, though it would be almost a pun, but it's possible. And the thing has to do with the fact that Apollonius and Paul are both said to have been itinerant miracle workers. They are said to follow a certain itinerary from one city to another, and it matches in the latter part of the book of Acts, the same towns and the same order. Mm-hmm. And that seems a little odd if it's not the same guy. And both of them have an encounter with one of the Caesars. It's Nero in one case and Domitian in the other, but they're associated in Revelation. I guess they could have been confused. So that's an interesting possibility. I wouldn't dismiss it. Could well be. I think someone else has argued it. I'm not absolutely sure, so I shouldn't put her name down and possibly libel her, but that's an interesting possibility. But of course, since these guys are, it could be that they're distinct people who, with their similarities, have been confused together. So it's always impossible to tell. It's also possible that Apollos in the book of Acts is Apollonius of Tyana. Mm-hmm. That is definitely a short form of Apollonius.
Well, absolutely. And you know, another Christian argument that I hear a lot regarding the dating of the Gospels is the... a lot of times Christians point to the rather abrupt ending of the book of Acts and kind of indicate that proves that the Gospel of Luke could not have been written at a date later than 64 AD. What's your take on that particular argument?
Yeah, that was originally put forth by Adolf Harnack in his book, The Dates and Authorship of the Synoptic Gospels and Acts. It's funny, the most fundamentalists who like this argument don't know it goes back to Harnack, whom they would despise and oppose for everything else he said. But it's superficially a strong argument, but it turns out to be brought down by a few important considerations. One of them is that if you look closely at what Paul says in Acts, it's obvious that the writer knows, the reader knows Paul is dead and that he was killed after he got to Rome. When in chapter 21, I think it is, Paul is meeting with a bunch of fans, and he says, well, I'm pressing on to Jerusalem, and I know none of you will see my... No, in chapter 19, he's talking to the Ephesian elders, and he says, I know none of you will see my face again. Mark this, after my departure, ravenous wolves will come in among you, and so on, and create heresies. Well, then they all hug him and say, oh, no, don't go. But he does anyway. And a few chapters later, he's in Palestine and again with friends. And Agabus, the prophet, ties himself up with a rope and says, the Holy Spirit says that this is going to happen to you if you press on to Jerusalem. And he says, look, I hear this everywhere I go, but I have to go and bring the gospel to Rome. Well, it's obvious this is written to people that know he went to Rome and died. Not only that, but there is this conscious parallel between Jesus and Paul in the structure of Luke and Acts. Both of them have itinerant preaching ministries. Both of them wind up in Jerusalem where there's a ruckus at the temple. They both are seized by Romans and have trials before both a Herodian official and a Roman procurator, too, in Paul's case. And then you know Jesus dies a martyr. What do you think's going to happen with Paul? It's like, for some reason, he doesn't want to actually say it. But then look at how the book ends. Paul was under house arrest in his own rented quarters for 2 years. And, you know. I mean, it's not like we're waiting to find out. It would be easy enough to say that, as in 2 Timothy. I'm awaiting trial, or Philippians, the same thing. It would be easy enough to say that, but it doesn't. It ends with, well, you know. And so I just think that is wrong, and that, plus there's lots of other internal evidence that indicates that it's a second century work. I mean, not even in the first century; it's got to be nearly mid second century.
Well, there's references to events that also occurred in the Bacchae, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, Euripides' play, I believe, about Dionysus in the Acts of the Apostles.
Well, yeah, that argument is not a bad one, but it ultimately fails. It's too much. It's not a stupid argument, but it just, once you look at it closely, it seems to me to fly in the face of most of the evidence.
Well, I just want to follow up. I mean, and there's clearly a lot of things described in the Book of Acts that date it at least beyond Josephus.
The use of Josephus, of course, is one of them. It's been pointed out, like, why is it that the author knows only of the messianic rebels that Josephus talks about, Judas of Galilee, Theudas the magician, and the unnamed Egyptian Messiah. Anna, brother.
Hey, Anna, boy.
I'm trying to get rid of this. And why would that be? I mean, if it was general knowledge that you had a whole lot of rebels, and Josephus says there were loads of them, how likely is that Acts and Josephus would mention exactly the same ones, and only three, and one of them neither would know the guy's name? And he even has Gamaliel name them in the order in which they appear in Josephus, even though they're out of order there, since one is mentioned as a flashback. It just seems like that Acts uses Josephus. Mm-hmm. Not that they have things in common, but that one was a source for the other.
Well, and they clearly used the Bacchae as a source for some of the tales he told in that book as well.
Euripides. Yeah, there's no way he doesn't have that in mind. The devotees of Dionysus and Christ both have the tongues of flame licking their hair and not harming them. Both groups are accused of being drunk, but they're not. They're in a divine ecstasy. The persecutor is told, look, don't do this. You might be found fighting against God. Why kick against the goads? There's a scene where Dionysus in human form comes into Thebes and is arrested, but there's an earthquake and he gets out, just like in Philippi. And there's so many parallels that it's just undeniable that he used the Bacchae.
I thought that it was interesting that there are some Eastern parallels with Buddha and everything that have some similarities, like Jesus and the fishes. Not the five loaves, but where he comes back from the dead and he meets them in the water and he tells them to throw, you know, the net over the side and the amount of fish that come back. I thought, if I remember right, that there was some parable about Buddha where something similar like that happened.
There might be one of those too, but I know there is a Pythagorean one in which you have the catch of fish. It's a little more parallel to the version in John, though you're right, it's also in Luke chapter 5. But the interest in John is that they count the fish as something that just seems ludicrous in the present context. Here's Jesus risen from the dead. Can you imagine what I'm saying? You guys go talk to the resurrected Son of God. I'll finish counting the fish. So what's it doing in there? It doesn't matter anyway. Well, it did in the Pythagoras version because there's no miraculous catch of fish, but there's a big catch of fish, and Pythagoras, who's sort of a vegan, doesn't want the fish killed. And he says, look, I know this sounds odd, but would you guys let the fish go back if I count if I guess the number right? Sure, go ahead. We got to count them anyway for inventory or whatever they did. And sure enough, he gets it right and they let him go. And Pythagoras gives him the equal amount of money. Well, in that case, it does matter. The number of fish. It doesn't in John anymore, and the catch, which wasn't a miracle, has become one. So this is a classic case where the Jesus miracle can be shown to stem from a Hellenistic pagan parallel. Though there are Buddhist elements too, like Simeon in the beginning of the Gospel of Luke, the old prophet who sees the infant Jesus and says, well, now I can die happy. I've seen the promised Savior. This is just like a Buddhist story where Asita, the sage, comes to embrace the baby Gautama and weeps. He has seen it, but he says, I know I'm never going to be able to live long enough to see him unveil the Dharma, but I got to see this much. That's pretty darn close, mm-hmm. and we know there was trade and missionary contact between the two. Of course, there had been long enough that needn't give it a second century date, but it would imply borrowing from other religions.
Exactly. Well, Cole, I think you had a question?
Yeah, I'm always interested in what people call themselves. I'm an atheist is what I call myself, and I saw a show last night. I'm not sure when it aired. But it was you, Bob, with John Loftus on the Enlightenment show with Mark Allen.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Interesting. I didn't get to see the whole thing. I agreed with John Loftus' definition of atheism. What is your definition?
I would say the operating supposition that there is no God running the universe. It's not a faith claim. Nobody decides to believe it, and nor is it a fanatical claim to absolute knowledge. It's just the notion that, you know, that just doesn't seem to be enough evidence to make this a compelling option. I mean, conceivably, there are little green men in the moon. I can't be sure there are not, but there's no real reason to take the possibility very seriously. Mm-hmm. So I take that to be atheism, and I would be an atheist in that sense.
Well, and so would I, but I would call myself an agnostic. But by your definition, I'm an atheist.
Well, that's what John said.
Yeah.
John Loftus was saying that, you know, it was too personal religion or personal God.
Right. But I guess, like, it's important to say that it doesn't offend me that it's that way. I just, I usually tell people I'm an agnostic just because I still feel that there is some doubt.
Yeah, and that's
so
my standard.
I'm comfortable with it.
Well, sometimes we doubt you.
Well, yeah, I'm fine with that.
We doubt that you exist sometimes.
But, you know.
Although I did say a little prayer and did bring me a little whiskey. Oh,
yeah. So, true.
Thank Howard.
But who would say they know beyond doubt there is no God? I mean, there's no particular reason to think there is, we would say. But who would say they have privileged knowledge like that?
Yeah. What would be the source of that privileged knowledge?
Sure. Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, how would he get a revelation from no God?
Well, speaking of atheism, what does it mean to be a Christian atheist, as you've described yourself in the past?
Well, it's a lot like religious humanism. I understand all religions to be the creations of human ingenuity and creativity, the human spirit, if you want to say that, though I don't want to say it in a spooky sense. I just mean human resourcefulness or whatever, the human imagination, that has given us all these myths that are, it seems to me, psychologically important, and all this music and liturgy and drama and so on, which I just find to be just beautiful, no matter what religion you're talking about. Mm-hmm. And I just cannot think that is evil or the enemy because they're taking literally the mythology. I think that represents a kind of sort of an adolescent understanding of it that people cannot escape because of the peer pressure. It can't really occur to most people to take it in a demythologized way, so they're not stupid. But I disagree with them taking it literally, but it is powerful and beautiful stuff. It can be made into a terrible engine of destruction, too, but then any philosophy can be, and has been, as with mm-hmm. the Nazis, the communists, and so on. So I love religion and would never want to see it end, though I don't believe there is any kind of a literal or personal or even watered down deity.
Well, and certainly if religion, and that would put a dent in your marketability.
Well, that's still be Lovecraft.
Yeah, that's true.
If they have any marketability, do you realize the pittance any of these publishers pay? Do you realize the impossibility of getting a respectable teaching job with views like mine?
Well, yeah, that
I
would
can't even get teach as an adjunct instructor anywhere because my views are on the internet. They don't want me. If I wanted to make a buck, I'd be an evangelical.
So you think religion shouldn't go away?
I think it would be tragic if it did. I would like to see people understand it in a better way than they do. And some might not like it so much if they did, but I think that's a fear that's unjustified. I think the benefits of religion would remain even if people no longer believed in supernatural powers and such. And I really disagree with Dawkins and Hitchens as much as I think they're brilliant on so many points. I just do not think that moderate religious people are giving aid and comfort to the enemy. That's just what they used to call the Walter Kaufman syndrome. You want religion to be as awful as possible so you can say, well, you see, that's wrong, and you want to make moderates who are not doing anything awful sound like fakes to get or hypocrites. So why don't you just drop it? Because then it would be real easy for us to point to religion as awful and criticize it. Well, it's not that simple. Especially it's hilarious to me when Sam Harris attacks religion and he's a Buddhist. He must not be that opposed to
it. I didn't know that.
Well, don't you think that? I mean, do you think that some of the fundamentalism is wrong? I mean,
or does any of that frighten you?
I mean, some of this doesn't seem to be healthy for society. I agree with the moderates, you know, that a lot of those are on the same page we are a lot of times. Some of my family is.
Yeah, that's kind of what I mean. I don't believe there's anything anti-human about religion. It only threatens to become that way once people believe in it in a supernatural way that leads to beliefs like, well, God told me to do this and it need not match up with reason. I've got faith, and if I'm to fly a plane into a building, that's the will of God. Like that kind of fanaticism is impossible with a moderated, rational religion, and that's a good thing. And it's just that the nuts the Islamo-fascists and the Christian Reconstructionists and people like that are just crazy fanatics. Religion didn't necessarily make them so, but insofar as it did, it was a fundamentalist literalism, and I would like to see that pass away. I think religion would not miss it.
Well, sometimes, you know, we go to Bible studies and churches and talk to preachers, and we have people come talk to our groups too. And sometimes I talk with moderates about if they feel that it's as much as their responsibility as ours to talk to these people, getting them on the same page. I mean, this anti-homosexuality and such, you know, these are the type of things I have problems with religion.
Yeah, I think that's true. There is a kind of even pastoral mission to try to edify the faith community, and that implies educating them toward a more loving, tolerant, peaceable attitude toward people. And you never know when that's going to happen. I was shocked to read that a few years before Jerry Falwell died, he and an old friend who had been a ghostwriter of his, Mel White, a ghostwriter for a lot of evangelical writers, he came out of the closet and admitted he was gay. And, of course, he got a lot of flack, and Falwell didn't even return his calls. I mean, a guy like him, what's he going to do? He doesn't know what to do. But Mel finally got a hold and said, Jerry, you know me. You know I'm no villain. What about we get an equal group of evangelicals who don't accept homosexuality, and those who do, like go to the churches I go to, meet at your church and just have a day of dialogue? And incredibly, Falwell agreed. And at the end of the thing, he said to the newspapers, you know, I still don't accept the moral validity of this, but I'm very ashamed of the stupid stuff I used to say about homosexuals. I should never have said that stuff, and we got to learn to get along. I thought, holy mackerel, maybe they're right and miracles do happen.
Well, this is exactly what I'm talking about, and this is what I really push for, and it happens, and we get ex-preachers and preachers talking to us. Some of them are agreeing, some of them are not helping, but we're getting closer and closer, and I think some of it helps.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, does it really burden those of us without these beliefs, the mere fact that others have them? Isn't it the results and the attitudes that they associated with it, intolerance and so on, that bothers them? I have communist friends that talk about who's going to be lined up against the wall and shot when the revolution comes. Well, they don't need fundamentalism to be vicious. They're vicious already.
Sure.
And
right.
That's my problem. I just find it interesting to meet people with different beliefs, as long as there's no wall and there doesn't have to be one.
I keep seeing, you know, more and more I keep seeing, you know, like you were talking about the moderate Christians, them getting on the same page as us and mismatching religions and just becoming more peaceful. And this is what I'm looking for, and we just got to work together getting the other side over.
I hate to stroke your ego here, Bob, but I have to tell you something that when I started hearing you doing the Bible Geek stuff, it was interesting to me because you basically helped me realize that I didn't need to reconcile the fact that I wanted, you know, that I still had people that go to church, friends of mine that are Christians. I play guitar at a church, several churches actually. I do all these things, and I enjoy to do them, and I enjoy to be involved in those groups just as much as I enjoy being involved with all of my other friends. It's no difference to me. And I thought the way that you put it in the Bible Geek, where, you know, you enjoy the litany, you enjoy being involved in your life, you know, with those people, and that the fact that you have a disagreement or, you know, disbelief in terms of what some of those people choose to believe is of no consequence.
Yeah, if they bring it up and throw it in your face all the time because they think they have to, well, that's too bad. You can't really get around that, but it doesn't have to be that way.
And that's totally true. I love that about your approach. I just want to tell you that.
Yeah, you just have, I mean, we're all, if you say you're a humanist, you got to love human beings. That has to come first, unless they make it impossible. And most people don't. I live in a town surrounded by fundamentalists and Pentecostals. I don't care what they think. They could be Buddhists or Sufis or Aztecs, as long as I wasn't on the list for sacrifice. It doesn't matter to me. I don't bring these things up, and they don't either. It's okay. I worry about people, the atheists that are like Dracula, and they wince at the cross, like these people that were objecting to a Mother Teresa stamp. What is this? You mean you can't even be religious and be legitimate? I mean, you no stamps for anybody that believes in God? Don't tell me that's not bigotry. I just feel like people are going way over the line there.
I would actually agree with that, because I'm actually in the minority sometimes in some of the groups when they're all talking about, oh, we shouldn't have In God We Trust on our money and all this stuff. And I'm like, well, why is that important? It's just words. I don't, you know, I don't see the point in making a big deal about it. So
Yeah, to me, that is just like the gospel passage in Matthew 23. It says, woe to you hypocrites, you strain out a gnat and swallow a camel. Who cares what it says in the coins? It says, what me worry? I don't care. You know, as long as there's the coins are still worth something.
That's all I amazing. Care about. They pay my bills. So that's all that matters to
yeah,
me.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Well, let's move on to another recent development in your life. I understand that you will be one of the hosts of the CFI podcast here in the future.
Yeah, Point of Inquiry.
Yeah, that's an excellent podcast.
Fun. I just was told this, and I hope I can measure up and do the job as well as you guys can. But I think I can probably. My first interviewee will be Bob Miller from the Jesus Seminar, who's brilliant and hilarious. Then after that, Thomas Altizer, the guy that invented Christian atheism, who wrote these controversial books in the 60s, like the Gospel of Christian Atheism. He's going to be on the show, I think, in April. And then Lois Schadewald. Robert Schadewald wrote these great books about pseudoscience and the flat earthers, and she's kind of carried on his legacy. I want to interview her then, and there's an endless stream of possibilities.
Oh, yeah.
I have to say that the flat earthers are just some of my favorite weirdos.
But have you seen the expanding earthers?
Ooh,
they
no,
believe
no,
that
I've
the earth
that.
Is expanded.
Yeah,
no. That it started out like a small ball, and that's the reason why we don't have continental drift. It was because all the continents pulled apart.
Right.
There was no shift. Shift to our tectonic plots. It was actually an expanding of the world.
Yeah,
now,
it's pretty out there.
is this like a aspect of some religious fundamentalism, or are these guys secular?
You know,
it's kind of a wackiness all in its own.
I think that one's just because actually one of the people that really promotes it is actually a comic book artist,
which one?
Arthur Adams.
Oh, what do you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So he's a flat earther.
Yeah.
Or he's expanding.
Expanding
earth. I've not heard that.
He's got a whole website about it and did some, like, there's some videos on YouTube where they explain the whole thing, and it's just, it's wild. I was kind of sitting there because I am a comic book fan, so I was kind of like.
Oh, me too.
Yeah. So I was kind of looking at it going, man, you're an art. Not to say that an artist can't be intelligent in other areas, but. Really?
Yeah, I don't know enough about that. I met one of the religion faculty at the, I forget what it's called now, but it used to be the University of Southern Missouri, who I don't remember his name. I don't really know him, but I met him once. He believed this. It was sort of a side interest of his. It wasn't part of his theology, but that was the first I'd heard of it. To tell you the truth, I don't know what would make that plausible or implausible. I'd have to look. It seems to me doubtful, but that's just because I've never heard of it before. It would explain the same phenomena, I suppose. But
If you know anything about plate tectonics and geology, it's almost like painful to watch because it's like, oh wow.
Well, it's certainly demonstrable whether it's happening or not.
Yeah,
I mean, that is something they can measure.
How long do they think it takes?
I can't remember. It's been a while since I went and watched the little YouTube thing, but yeah.
Have to take a look
you know
at
what,
that.
Bob?
Yeah,
I think it's more than 100 years.
It's more than 100 years.
Bob, I think I know where you're going with that, and that's the. the young earth creationists, it seemed like it could be a good tool for him to have a little, you know, yet another conundrum for them to overcome.
For the
the flat earthers at least are consistent literalists. I don't believe you can really show there is a problem between Genesis and evolution. The interpretation of Genesis that the creationists espouse is very arbitrary and unnatural, whereas it plainly says the earth is flat. Of course, most creationists won't touch that one, but at least the flat earthers are consistent, if crazy.
Right. Yeah. I have to agree with that.
Well, the earth is held up by pillars, if I remember correctly.
Oh, right, yeah. Or I think the firmament is. The solid dome over the flat.
No, it's on the back of a turtle. Back of a turtle.
Well, I just watched the other day, it's on the back of a turtle that has elephants holding it up, too.
That's right. I heard that, too.
Well,
Bob, back to the CFI thing. When you start doing that?
I believe in early March. They haven't given me the exact date yet.
Well, I'll definitely be looking forward to that. So, and DJ Grothy, I believe he was the person who used to do that. He's moved on to the Randy Foundation, didn't he?
Yeah, that's right. Another great comic book fan.
Woohoo!
See, I never got into the comic books, but I used to be I still am a huge Star Trek fan.
Oh, that's great stuff, too.
Which I believe you and I have in common. And that's another question I wanted to ask you. Are you more of a Kirk or Picard devotee?
I love them both. I think the Kirk shows are better dramatically, but I really love both versions.
Well, you can't. You have to enjoy Kirk's. Who's the actor who plays Kirk?
William Shatner.
William Shatner's flair for the for melodramatic interpretations.
He edges out. He edges out Picard for me. I have to admit, Picard's cool, but Kirk, he just, you know, if you're going to pick somebody for a fight, that's who I'd pick.
Oh yeah.
Well, the problem with Next Generation was
about it.
They had it written by a bunch of left-wing pacifists, and so they didn't want any fist fights, and that kind of translated into no action of any kind. Mm-hmm. So Worf was only there to get the stuffing beat out of him by villains who were even stronger, and finally Roddenberry got rid of these writers, and it got better after that, but they just sapped the whole thing of any of the dramatic tension and adventure that the original had.
Well, yeah, the first season of The Next Generation tried to keep intact the weird encounters with the just really bizarre and unimaginable races.
That's true. They did a good job of that.
But you're right. It was just pacifistic, and I mean, it just kind of lost its heart. And they corrected that somewhere around the second or third season. But yeah, the first season of The Next Generation was kind of painful to me.
Mm. So did you enjoy the new restart with the new Star Trek film?
Yeah, I did. I thought they were compressing a little too much into it, but I can understand that for the point of it, and they admitted it was an alternate timeline, and I thought it was really a lot of fun and surprisingly well done.
Oh, yeah.
I did, too. As did I. Everybody was perfect as the characters.
Well, the guys who played Bones.
I love him. He was great, awesome. Yeah. He's my favorite.
And, the engineer. What's the engineer's name? I cannot think of
Scotty.
Scotty. I mean, those guys did a phenomenal job. I didn't care for the depiction of Spock. I mean, they put him in some situations that were very un-Spock-like. But
But then again, he wasn't without emotion. He just tried to suppress it.
Right.
The one thing I would have done differently is begged, borrowed, or blackmailed what's his name? He was in Goodfellas. Ray Liotta into playing Captain Pike.
That would have been so good.
Yeah, I do like Ray Liotta. So, well, anyway, do we have any more questions for the Honorable Mr. Price?
No.
Or Professor Price? Well, Bob, thanks for being on the show. I really did enjoy this. As we mentioned, you're doing the CFI podcast. Are you going to continue doing the Bible gig?
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
you
thank
bet.
You. Thank you.
Just so you know, Marshall may not say it, but... Bob, we'd love to have you again.
Oh, yeah.
Anytime.
Definitely.
Hey, if you're ever through Kansas City, stop in.
Oh my God, yes. You are literally one of my heroes, and I'm...
I appreciate it.
I will be buying your upcoming books, because I enjoy everything you do.
Yeah, I'm in the middle of a reason-driven life right now, and it's exceptional. It really is.
That one I haven't read. I'll have to look at that. And I think I passed on that just because I have no interest in Rick Warren. Just makes my skin crawl, to be honest with you. And I don't want to read anything that's going to remind me of him. So anyway, well, thanks for being on the show.
Oh, thanks for having me. See you soon, I hope.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Bob.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, well, that was fun. And everyone listening, thanks for listening, and next time. Bye.
Well, last time we recorded, we had our interview with Bob Price, and I made a mistake when I spoke about the expanding Earth theory and which comic book artist champions that cause. It wasn't Arthur Adams; it is Neil Adams. So, if Mr. Arthur Adams is listening, I apologize for throwing your name in there.
Which is doubtful, but hey, buddy, we're sorry.
Yes. And in compliance with Sharia law, she will be caned for this offense.